Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am Giuseppe Porcaro, Head of Outreach and Governance, and for this episode, I am with Alicia Garcia Herrero, who is a senior scholar at Bruegel. Hi, Alicia. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Giuseppe.
Are you still in Hong Kong or are you back in Europe?
I'm back in Europe in a little town called Burgos, medieval town in the middle of nowhere in Spain, enjoying it.
Fantastic. And I have also here Elena Rybakova, who is a deputy chief economist of the Institute for International Finance in Washington, D.C. Hi, Elena. How are you?
Hi, Giuseppe. I'm fine. Thank you. Nice to be on this podcast.
Great. So we are very much connected, as usual, across the planet for our Sound of Economics. And today we are going to dive a little bit deeper into a paper that Elena and Alicia have just published at Bruegel. The paper is on the impact of COVID-19 in the emerging economies. You can find the link to the papers in the show notes. And the topic is quite vast, and the pandemic has been hurting the emerging economies in at least three ways. By locking down their population, damaging the exports earnings of those countries, and deterring foreign capital. So even if the pandemic will fade in the second half of the year, GDP in developing countries measured at purchasing power parity will probably be 6.6% smaller in 2020 than the IMF had forecast in October. This is just a very short glimpse or like a flash photograph about the dramatic situation that the emerging economies are living and about to live. But I would like to ask Alicia and Elena to tell us a little bit more about what has been going on in the past few months, what is currently going on, and what we need to expect.
Thanks very much, Giuseppe, for this intro. It's really a pleasure to be here with Elena. This is our first paper together. I have to make this announcement, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's been a wonderful discussion on topics that were really at the top of my mind when I used to be an economist at the IMF and looking at all of these financing issues around the EM space. And, you know, I thought I had seen it all because I happened to have worked on the Mexican crisis in 94 and, you know, then the Asian financial crisis in 97. So I never thought there would be anything like that again. And it so happens, and our paper, I think, makes that point very clearly, that in terms of dollar liquidity, and by dollar, Elena and I are very careful in kind of extending that concept because things have changed a lot in the last few years, in the sense that sometimes it's not necessarily only dollar financing. It might simply be external financing because many countries have increased massively the share of non-residents in their local currency bond issuance. So when we say dollar financing, what we really mean is external financing, because once those non-residents want to be repaid, and this is partially what has been happening big time since COVID-19 starting, they will ask for the dollars back. So it's a dollar problem. It's just not necessarily defined in dollars from the very beginning. But that dollar shortage that has been the reason for many of the financial crises in the emerging market space is back to the forefront with COVID-19. And there's no better way to look at that or to see the magnitude of what we are discussing here than the first figure in this paper we wrote, which shows how much bigger this shock is in terms of exit of capital from the emerging market space compared to things we thought were really big, such as the global financial crisis in 2008, the tapering tantrum of the Fed in 2013, or what we call the China scare when the stock market in China collapsed in 2015. So it's literally like six times bigger, a shock in terms of capital outflows. And that says it all. We can also measure the extent of the problem by just focusing on the number of countries that have knocked at the IMF's door to request financial assistance, over 100 by now. You know, the estimated amount of financing that emerging markets will need as a result of this exit of capital, $2.5 trillion. So, you know, all of this is just to set the stage of how bad the situation is already. And I leave the floor, Giuseppe, go back to you to talk more in detail about regions, if you'd like.
Elena, do you want to add something on this first outline from Alicia, which doesn't look really good?
I think it's important to highlight, and especially Alicia brought it back to the 90s and the IMF, and the good solid advice was, well, we have to move away from the original sin, the so-called borrowing and foreign exchange for emerging markets, and develop liquid, deep, local markets. And of course that helps, but as great work by our colleagues, Ellen Ray and others have shown that even though you might have flexible exchange rate regime, if you have foreign investors in your local markets, you still don't have enough flexibility or room on the monetary policy to respond. You're still highly integrated into the global financial flows. And indeed, on the way out, investors will be asking for dollars because they will have to convert. And also the recent work by the BIS, where they're showing that for emerging markets, swings in the local market rates or the cost of funding in local currency is very related to the currency, to the exchange rates. This is not the case for developed markets, for the dollar or for the European markets. And I think this still highlights this separation or key vulnerability that the emerging markets have, that they're very integrated into the global financial markets. They're reliant on dollar or foreign exchange funding, even though they might have developed their local markets as many multinational organizations have recommended them to do. And I think that's an important lesson also from this crisis.
I think it's a common aspect in the various emerging economies, is something that makes them having a common problem. But are there some, I mean, Alicia mentioned before that we could just briefly touch upon, if we're speaking about Indonesia or we are speaking about, Argentina or Brazil, I mean, we are speaking about totally different kind of universes in the world, or like even Turkey and so on. Are there the way those different economies are connected to the rest of the world play a role in that needs to be considered in this context, or we are really on a situation where the shocks are so much across the line that actually it doesn't really matter where you are because we are all sharing the same shock and the same shortage?
I think there's a number of things to consider. Well, of course, not every country is in the same situation. That is and there's many reasons. One is to start the size of the shock. So, you know, some countries have gone through a much bigger sanitary problem than others, number of cases, deaths, and so on. The second is the size and duration of the lockdown. So, you know, obviously Europe, we are at the extreme of the reduced mobility because of very, very tight lockdowns. Other, among the emerging market space, there are many, many differences, which of course will imply a smaller shock directly because of the size and length of the lockdown. But the third, and that's what you're referring to, which is very important, is really their vulnerabilities, economic vulnerabilities, as well as the room for monetary and fiscal stimulus. So first, the vulnerabilities. How can we measure that? Well, the paper goes through, you know, not in length because that's not really what we are trying to cover. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to give a sense of where we stand. But external debt is so much bigger in Latin America than in Asia. Some parts of Asia, by the way, are actually net external creditors. They're not even net debtors. So, you know, I would argue that within, and I'm only going to cover Latin America and Asia here, it's like totally different in terms of both degree of vulnerabilities and fiscal and monetary space. So Asia has more fiscal and monetary space on average. And, you know, we will talk about that later, but also the degree of of cushions, the size of their cushions. By cushions, I mean forex reserves. And of course, Asia has, again, more forex reserves than Latin America. So vulnerabilities on the one hand, and by vulnerabilities, I mean current account deficits, fiscal deficits, external debt, and also dependence on dollar flows. Imagine a country that is just a big, you know, which depends massively on tourism. Dollar income coming from tourism, say Thailand. Well, Thailand then, because of that sector being massively affected, will be experiencing a bigger shock than a different country. And then the question is, how much room does Thailand have as opposed to another country? So we have to think about vulnerabilities, dependence on the dollar, which is part of the vulnerability story, fiscal and monetary space, and then, of course, the cushion meaning how many reserves they have to accommodate the shock. So yes, on my side, Asia does look generally more resilient than clearly Latin America.
Okay, but then within this space, clearly there is a certain margin or less margin or more margin of maneuver for each of those countries and those economies to react. But and there I would like to ask Elena, which actually are, I mean, you go very much in depth in your paper, which are the various options available to confront those liquidity problems that each of those countries can use.
Thank you. I just also wanted to say it's such a pleasure working with Alicia because she puts it exactly to the key fault lines that one needs to focus on. Not just a general lecture on emerging market vulnerabilities, but exactly what is the key point and this reliance on FX funding, no matter what, you know, over the last 20 years for emerging markets. So what can we do, right? You know, we advise them, have flexible exchange rate regimes, have, you know, prudent fiscal and monetary policies, and then you will have something on the domestic policy front. So the first line of defense, you can do something on domestic policies. But as Alicia has highlighted, you know, many of them don't have that room. And even if you have flexible exchange rate regime, you don't have the same monetary policy independence that we have promised emerging markets from our old-fashioned traditional open economy macroeconomic models. It doesn't work the same. It's written on paper, unfortunately. Then the next solution, you can do capital controls. And the IMF has changed its view on capital controls and also has softened the language around it. They call it now capital flow management measures. And there are some authorities out there that love the terminology. And they say it's not capital controls, it's capital flow management measure. So you can, much better. It's about market. It's marketing, right?
It sounds better. So
with that in mind, you know, you can do capital controls or flow management. But for example, in April, we had very strong issuance from emerging markets. That means emerging markets came and placed bonds, and there are a lot of asset managers that bought it. Long-term investors, obviously, as well as some banks, we have the data. And that means if you were to put in those capital controls in the middle of the crisis, you wouldn't be able to access the market for many years afterwards. And there is very good literature on that. It takes you a long time to regain trust of the market to be able to access. So that also has a problem. Of course, you can do self-insurance. You know, before the crisis, you accumulate your reserves. And for example, in my region, Russia has done exactly that, partially motivated by sanctions. They decided they're going to build Fortress Russia, reduce external vulnerabilities to extreme. But that also comes at a cost, and many emerging markets don't have it. You have some in Asia, you have in Russia, but you know most others, South Africa, Latin America, especially countries that said, look, we have flexible exchange rate regime. Why do we need reserves? Now, of course, this is the new reality. It turns out, no, you have flexible exchange rate regime, but you still need FX reserves to provide this FX liquidity in emergency. So again, many of those are not prepared with the reserves accumulation. And then finally, you know, those unhappy with the IMF, you know, said the IMF is not good. We're going to have our regional insurance and we're going to help each other. And there's BRICS, you know, bank. And then there is the multilateralization initiatives in Asia. But unfortunately, they haven't been really operational, even this time around. We know, of course, Qatar has stepped up the swap line to Turkey. It's going to help a bit on the margin. But those sort of regional insurance schemes are not yet fully functional. So there are not that many options for the emerging markets right now. And you have to go to some sort of a global lender of last resort, whether it's a key central bank or, in the end of the day, IMF.
I see, Alicia. Beside those measures that that Elina has been clearly setting, explaining, what about the G20? Did the G20 action? I mean, it was like announced in big pompa magna on mid-April that they would have done something to freeze the debts of or like the payments of the debts for a year and so on. Is that something that is really having an impact, or is it rather another of those things that that are just falling into the realm of the public declarations and won't really be followed up so much?
It's a great question for a number of reasons. First of all, before we even started this policy paper, I tried very hard to write this kind of, you know, throw the bottle to the ocean, see if somebody would take it, on where's the G20? Where's the G20? Where's the G7? I even wrote a piece with Guntram, which was called A Letter to Santa. Santa mm-hmm. was the mm-hmm. G7, and etc. So, you know, it's like for, but you're right. Finally, in mid-April, they came up with this wonderful news that 20 billion equivalent of external debt would be relieved to the emerging world, and most importantly, to highly indebted developing countries. So, you know, the lowest part of the income level of the emerging market space. I have to clarify, though, that the paper Elina and I are writing is not really focusing on solvency. This is a solvency measure. We're talking about liquidity. So our paper is more about, you're a big country, Turkey. Maybe you're not insolvent. But frankly speaking, because you have, and Elina knows the numbers better, but you know, I used to work on the covered Turkey years ago. The numbers were just frightening, frankly speaking. Like, I don't know, 70% of external debt was less than a year. And, you know, it basically dominated the balance of payments of this country. So why? Because they got used to this short-term financing. It was easy to get financing, you know, from the London offshore center and even place to large extent, even local currency. It wasn't even a dollar trade. It was a Turkish lira trade, and it all looked very appealing, high yield, and people would, you know, not high yield, but meaning high yield in the sense, nice return, everybody was happy. Now, it so happens that suddenly COVID-19 comes to the forefront and the cost of funding goes to the moon. What do you do? So the G20 can't help Turkey with the debt reduction. Why? Because it's not a solvency issue. What Turkey needs is to be sure it will have enough financing, external financing, that those lines, that those asset managers buying Turkish lira treasuries less than a year will remain. Now, the most similar thing we can think of is probably what happened after the 2008 financial crisis in Europe. Is this, and Elina knows a lot about this, is that they call the Vienna Accord, by which European banks, Vienna Initiative, European banks were actually decided, you like it or not, yeah, I mean, coercively, but still willingly, to keep their lending, cross-border lending, in emerging Europe. So what we are trying to focus on in our paper is really about that liquidity issue before it becomes, which can be the case though, a solvency issue. Now, G20 hasn't come to a real offer for these systemically important emerging economies. It has offered 20 billion to highly indebted poor countries for which this 20 billion might be enough. I'm not judging, I really don't know. But those 20 billion for countries like Brazil, Russia, if push comes to shove, I agree with Elina that maybe Russia won't be the next, but you know, there's others out there, Turkey, it's certainly not enough. So, and it's not the purpose. You see, it's not about debt reduction. It's about flows continuing. Could the G20 do something? Indeed. Indeed. For example, we can talk about the Fed later, but it's a unilateral decision. The Fed offers swap lines, dollars, bilaterally, what about the G20 offering, you know, multiple swap lines among different major central banks in the world? That has not been proposed, let alone decided. So everything that was decided was really a pocket of issues related to solvency for poor countries.
That's very clear. That's very clear, Elizabeth. You mentioned now the Fed and you mentioned swap lines. And cross-border bank liquidity. What the Fed has been doing, because my impression is that they've been acting faster than in 2008, but they only acted for certain countries and not necessarily for the majorities or the countries within the emerging economies landscape that that would really need that kind of stuff.
Well, on the positive, and I let Elena add to this, on the positive, they've acted quickly. And frankly speaking, sitting at, you know, in my daily life, nightlife is for Bruegel, but daily life is sitting on the global markets with traders and looking at what was happening in March, I can tell you the minute I saw these swap lines on the Fed being increased for, say, Japan, Bank of Japan, or you know, with better financial conditions for these developed central banks, and then finally come to those who used to have had those swap lines, such as the Reserve Bank of Australia, which had lost access and needed access desperately in March. I was thinking, you know, God save the Fed, if I may say that, because without those swap lines at that speed, I actually think we would have had a major liquidity problem in March in the world. So that's, you know, thanks God, I have to say. The problem, and you're absolutely right, is that those swap lines are only offered to central banks the Fed knows well, meaning central banks, the Fed actually offered swap lines back in 2008. And it only includes, to my dismay, let's put four, not all of them might be considered emerging markets, although they appear in the definition, South Korea, Singapore, that's what I mean, they are more developed than many developed countries, but we still call them emerging markets, it's very stupid, but anyway, and Brazil and Mexico. But there's nothing there for others, so this is why it's quite worrisome. They've created, and I let Elena go into the repo line and all of that, but I would finish by saying before she starts, it's not enough. Although I do appreciate what the Fed did. And it's not enough because it can't be, because the Fed can't be the lender of last resort of the world for dollars. It's just not its mandate.
Okay, so if we don't have the Fed as a lender of last resort, capital controls are not enough, and the regional mechanisms that you describe, they are kind of dormant in this kind of phase, or they are not enough strong or developed for facing such a shock, such the one that we are having at the moment. What is left on the ground, Elena? What do we have left for the emerging economies to appeal to?
Sitting around in Washington, D.C., of course, there's a natural Bretton Woods institutions come to mind, right? So they were originally set up to deal with the balance of payment shocks. In those days, it was mostly terms of trade shocks, but nowadays the capital account is overwhelmingly much more important, but of course, trade shocks as well. For emerging markets, they rely on all of the balance of payments and flows to on effects on the foreign currency liquidity. So we have the IMF, which is supposed to be able to react. What are the issues around it, right? We've sent lots of announcements, lots of positive news in April. 100 countries came to ask for help from the IMF. There are daily updates about some this or the other country qualifying for sort of rapid disbursement facilities. But there is a big caveat, or rather two big caveats. So one is all this new, or not even so new, but the rapid financing instruments, they are limited to a very small amount of borrowing. And the fund defines it as a percentage of quota. What is a quota? It's sort of like an ownership stake that you have at the IMF. And most of the emerging markets and frontier markets have very small ownership stake. And as a result, they qualify for a very small amount of assistance. So this rapid financing is only about 100% of quota, not much more. It's easy to get, you know, it's your debt has to be sustainable on the way of being sustainable. So it's more for a liquidity problem. But, you know, for a country like South Africa, they're going to get about $6 billion. It's a drop in the ocean. For them, they have market access. Their one Eurobond issuance is probably just about that amount. So it's just not enough for these countries. What are the facilities they have? The IMF learned the lesson in 2009, said, okay, fine, we're going to give you some sort of like a swap line. You know, we call it flexible kind of credit line, you know, to call it differently. You can pre-qualify for it. It doesn't have any conditionality and it's almost unlimited. Well, let's check how many countries have used it. I think historically about four. That's it. You know, there is basically nobody can possibly qualify for this swap line. So we have this time around, we have Chile, Peru, and historically we've also seen Colombia, Mexico, and Poland use this line. But the IMF has been puzzled why not more countries are using it. Well, the reason being is that it's almost impossible to qualify for it. For many countries, an illiquidity shock, if unaddressed, can result in solvency issues. And also amidst such a big shock like COVID or combination of shocks, there is such high uncertainty about who is sustainable or not sustainable. It's very hard to qualify for this flexible credit line. And I think, so this is the first big point. We have very still limited scope of instruments and access to these instruments from the fund. On the other hand, of course, if you're very tight with your money, you have enough money, right? So if you have limited instruments and nobody can qualify it, of course, then the fund has enough resources. But if you say, okay, we are going to be the real lender of last resort for emerging markets with market access normally, well, then for that, the fund, I don't think, has enough funding. And the fund has funding via these quotas where everybody chips in a little bit. But let's not forget that if we chip in and then we borrow, then my quota is no longer available for somebody else to borrow, right? And then it's very dominated by a few countries still. And there is the whole big issue of the quota reform, which we can talk about. It's a big political thorny issue. So then, of course, the fund said, okay, well, it's very tricky. And the US doesn't want to increase the SDR allocation. So let's go hat in hand and ask for some sort of bilateral arrangements where countries are going to top up our existing capital. But if you're thinking about the IMF in terms of the funding or structure or the capital structure, it's actually this core capital of quotas is proportionately relatively low. So you cannot be relying on the bulk of your funding with the hat in hand and ask for each parliament to keep on approving that on a rolling basis. Because, for example, they were prepared to increase and double some of these funding facilities from countries, but it needs to be approved. And COVID happens to have happened this year before all of them got approved. You know, you don't have this, beauty of perfect timing. So these are the two issues with the IMF, we think, and we highlight in the paper, is that the funding programs are not fully adequate, and then there's not enough resources at the fund.
It seems that... If on one hand there are certain instruments that could be used at IMF level, there is also there quite a big problem in terms of, capacity and liquidity and then political will of reforming the instruments that could be used for this purpose. So a little bit going towards the end of this conversation, what is your take? Because the situation that you described, both of you, at the beginning of this podcast is rather dramatic in terms of what are going to be the consequences for those countries, but also for the global economy in general, and something that in absolute numbers and in relative considerations is going to affect everyone beside those directly touched in the emerging economies. Where do we go from there? What is our take?
It's kind of a coordination problem, if you see what I mean. And that's why Lynn and I were really keen on writing this paper. And not that we are the only ones making this point, but the more the merrier, because it's so important. What we really wanted to point out, perhaps beyond what we've been reading, is that there needs to be a pecking order. Because what you said is very important. We have a problem. We are all aware of this problem. There's many problems we're not even touching upon in this paper, like solvency. You know, I mean, countries that were at the brink of becoming insolvent are now, by now, insolvent because, you know, their debt dynamics are so much worse, their growth prospects are so much worse. We're even, I mean, in our paper, we're frankly speaking, and sorry to say, forgetting about those. We're only focusing on liquidity. And even by focusing on liquidity, which as, you know, kind of orthodox economies, we tend to think should be solved. I mean, the kind of IMF mantra, if it's a liquidity problem, I'm there to help. If it is a solvency problem, I'm not necessarily there to help unless there is a haircut, unless, you know, blah, blah, blah. But if there is a liquidity problem, I should be there to help. So we are making this point. Forget about other solvency problems. Focus on the liquidity problems. You're not there to help. And this is not even the IMF's fault because the IMF is screaming as we speak. I mean, like, if you read the IMF speeches later, I feel even sorry, you know, that an institution like the IMF has to scream for help, meaning, please, and this was true, Lina went through the different facilities, you know, they had to plead to get a new facility on liquidity. I mean, you know, it's like the house is on fire and the IMF, which is the literally, which is the pecking order, another pecking order, basically the one and only there left, is doesn't have any water to you know,
to
dab this fire. Yeah. And I'm not even talking about the amount of water, which would be the funding, is that the actual right instrument has not been approved since 2017. We make that point in the paper. So basically, I'm just saying it is to me, and I can understand the world is, you know, in shambles. We're all suffering from lockdowns, but this is quite irresponsible. I would use this word, and that's why for us, this paper is kind of a screaming, you know, where as the IMF is screaming for a solution because liquidity problems will become solvency problems unless something is done in between. And the pecking order, going back to that point, which is if I'm a great country and I have monetary and fiscal room, I may not even have to come to the IMF. Well, this is the luxury of very few, very, very few. Say we tick 3 countries in the whole EM space, you know, fine. We're left with 100 plus, you know, like this pecking order, you know, is like so difficult. Very few countries have enough forex reserves. So you go back to 100, a little bit less than 100 something. And so you end up with 100 countries. I mean, going all of them to the IMF at the very same time. So that's the idea of our pecking order. It's kind of impossible to narrow down the countries that will not need help. That's why we focus on this point. Thus, the IMF needs to find a solution. And to do that, and I'm happy about your question on the G20 probably is the best place to go because, you know, the G7 itself might not even have alone the necessary funding ability to deal with this issue. So it does boil down to the G20 at some point. We don't cover that in the paper, but I do think your question was absolutely well taken.
Thank you. Thank you, Alicia. And we are going towards the end of this episode. I would just like to ask Elina if she has some final comments on this, because I think that you really have been, both of you, exhausting the arguments and explaining it in a very accessible manner, something that I have to admit is not exactly the core of my competencies. And therefore, you managed to actually explain what is the issue in a very accessible manner also for our listeners. Elina, do you want to add something as a final remark?
Thank you. I think it is very important that we are rethinking the way we analyze international monetary policy and international macro period. And the IMF's initiative was the integrated policy framework and whatever the marketing around the capital flow management measures. It is important. I think for all of us in policy and academia, it's important to start thinking out of the box because the old books on the international market are not as relevant. And as well on the swap lines, you know, there's definitely warrants further work. And we, with Alicia, started starting on it already, is that what other central banks are doing. You know, you cannot place all your hope on the Fed. You know, the Fed is at the risk of being overburdened also from the political point of view. You know, there is, why would they be expanding further their balance sheet for the emerging markets, where the only one game in town, not only domestically, but also internationally.
Thank you, Alina. Alicia, Elina, thank you so much. And thanks to all our listeners for having tuned in for this episode of The Sound of Economics. I would like to remind to all of you that the paper that we discussed today on the impact of COVID-19 pandemic in the emerging economies, especially focusing on the issue of liquidity, can be found on our website www.bruegel.org. And until next time, bye-bye.